Welcome to Community Conversations with State Attorney Bain, your talk show for insights on the criminal justice system, community issues, and public safety in Orange and Osceola counties. Join State Attorney Andrew Bain as he dives into the issues that matter most to you, keeping it real every step of the way.
All right, welcome everybody to another episode of Community Conversations with State Attorney Andrew Bain. For those listening to the sound of my voice, I am Andrew Bain. I am the state attorney for the 9th Judicial Circuit of Florida, covering both Orange and Osceola counties. But our conversation we're going to have today is going to be something that we're going to reach beyond what happens here in our circuit. And is a more general conversation about our criminal justice system in its totality. And so part of my job, people want to ask me, like, so, you know, what's so difficult? You know, is it the cases? Is it, you know, the facts? Is it the people? You know, and, you know, it's really, I find the most difficult thing is just trying to find a balanced approach to what we do for a living. And so part of my job is to hold people accountable for making bad choices. You know, and some of the choices that, you know, they make are choices that hurt other people. They injure our public in its totality. And sometimes people think that, well, it's just this one isolated minor choice that, and we should not do anything about it and we should just let it go. And I would, you know, say that that's probably not true. We should not do that because, you know, it has resounding effects if we don't control how our society is operated and functions, especially when it comes to upholding the laws that we all come to know and pass and trust that we send our representatives to Tallahassee or Washington and they, you know, pass laws that, you know, come to effect. And a lot of those laws have good reasons to be so. And so if you were looking at what happened last week as well, besides the election, you know, election took up a lot of people's time, but also some other important things that happened in the past about a week and a half. You know, Walgreens, for instance, is going to close 1,200, like almost, I think, almost 12,000 stores across the nation, partially we do because of retail theft. And so we think about just theft as this a, you know, kind of, you know, this isolated little small instance that, you know, we shouldn't do anything about. But if it compounds itself and keeps going on and on, it doesn't just affect small businesses and, you know, people, mom and pop shops. It starts affecting larger corporations and how they decide to operate. So it's about finding, for me, the balanced approach about what we do. And so big part of that is there's a disciplinary type function of the criminal justice system. And it's a punitive type like setup based on how the Florida legislature has set up our laws. So sentencing, for instance, for very violent offenses, gun offenses, high level trafficking offenses, it carries some very serious penalties because our legislature feels that, hey, these crimes harm the very core of who we are as a community and as a person. And there's some other nonviolent offenses that also occur in that process. And those processes, those still have a punitive nature to what they do. But the idea is that there's supposed to be a balanced approach of both penalizing the person for breaking the law and also providing a space where we can rehabilitate that person and getting them back into our society. And so a lot of what we do at his office is about dealing with that balanced approach. How do we balance those two things? How do we balance, you know, the punitive nature of our jobs with the rehabilitative nature of our jobs? And then the big part of the conversation we're going to have today is that how do we, you know, impose penalties as well as then after the penalty has been imposed, reintegrate that person back into our society, put them on the right track, to be successful and not to recidivize. Now, this is a big conversation. Like I'm going to tell you that right now, this is a big conversation that we're not going to get to all the points of it today. It's going to be different, the different ways and aspects and ways of looking at it. But the bottom line is that as a society, we have to decide how we want to move forward with people coming back into our society. So, you know, you know, our good friend Desmond Mead has coined the phrase returning citizen as a way to, you know, I guess they call it PR, what was happening when somebody returns to our community from spending time in a state prison or federal prison. But the real reality, what really you have to talk about is what level of reintegration can we have? And but and on the core of that, and what level of forgiveness do we have as a community that we wanted to spread beyond just the case and the system? So that is really the where the crust of what we're going to talk about is going to come from. And it's because it is really about, you know, really how do we get down to making sure that, A, we hold people accountable. Because, you know, there's no way, for us, where this is a father of two little girls, the son, I've been a son. I've had both of my parents in my life, which has been a blessing compared to a lot of other people. But at the end of the day, I was actually interviewing my mom because she's going through some health issues. And I wanted to make sure that I was able to capture some of her wisdom for my children. And one of the biggest things she told me about parenting was about, hey, you have to be patient and you have to make sure that you provide discipline for your like for your children. And because that's going to make sure that they're going to be able to grow up to be a successful adult. And we got to do the same thing when we bring people back into our community. We have to, there has to be some level of patience that has to come along with it, but it also has to be a level of discipline that we have to instill, because that's the only way that we're going to get that person back on track. And as a community, our response has to be in a way to make sure that we're going to be able to do that in a compassionate and straightforward manner. And so, and there's like, so there's like, so right now we're in a phase where in our nation, and even in Florida, there's that conversation that's going on a lot. You're going to hear from my good friend, Sharon Driver. She's from S&D Enterprises. And then you're going to hear also from Reginald Fullwood. And he's from Operation New Hope. And they both have the same goal in both re-entering people back into our society. They come at it from different perspectives. And they've been able to make moves, not just on the ground, but also in Tallahassee, to make sure that we're also on a plan to allow for our community to thrive and survive. Because the real reality is that I don't want cases. I don't like cases. I don't want new cases. That means because every time I have a new case, I have a new victim, I have a new cost that's gonna be put on our community, that's gonna have to be burdened. And then if we have to incarcerate somebody, that's a whole additional cost that's gonna be on our community and on our taxpayers. And, you know, we're not going to make sure that the person is going to be able to be reintegrated to our society. We're going to just then just be in a circle of putting people back into prison for things over and over again. And a lot of this has to do, unfortunately, reality is that with the person, the individual, because the individual has to decide that this is going to be a change, that there's going to be something that's going to change. I'm not going to come out and redo the same crime over and over and over again. I want to make the change to make myself a better person, to make myself a better reality. Because it unfortunately happens. When I first came in, when I got in the office, it was just, you know, kind of serendipitous in a way that I was kind of flipping through a news app and I saw a picture of a person. And I was like, I recognize this person. And I clicked on it and it was someone I had sent to prison before when I was originally a prosecutor back in the first part of my career, and they were doing the same crime, like identically the same exact crime that I sent them to prison for when they got out. Because I looked at the time, they had just got out of prison, they went back to doing the same exact crime, just moved counties. They moved out of our circuit and went to Lake County and did it. And so I remember listening to her speak on jail calls when our case was going on, and it was kind of like she had resigned herself to this way of life, and that's an unfortunate reality that goes on sometimes. That sometimes people resign themselves to just committing, the same crimes and thinking that there's no way out. But we're going to talk to some people right now. I'm bringing on our good friend Sharon Driver that is about changing that mindset. And she's going to talk a little bit about S&D Enterprises and what that means for our community and kind of what the work she's been doing. So, Ms. Driver, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you. Thank you so much. And to the panel, the distinguished guests, Mr. Fullwood, it is a pleasure to be on today. So I'm open to discuss and say.
Tell people what I want to do. But first, I want to do is have everybody introduce their organizations, what they do, and then we'll get into the bigger conversation of reentry after that. So tell the people about what SCD Enterprises is and everybody in Pine Hills that's listening to 98.5 and online and on social media that, you know, kind of what your program does and what it provides for our community.
Absolutely. Well, my name is Sharon Driver. I am the CEO and founder of S&D Enterprises. I, too, am a returning citizen, once sentenced to 20 years in Department of Correction. Unfortunately, breaking the law sentenced me to that time. However, being educated and able to read and write, assisted in writing my appeal and was able to give back 15 years of that time. Since being home, I've reacclimated myself back into society to be able to do what I do today, which is housing for returning citizens as well as homelessness. But this is what I do every day. I'm a firm believer of second chances. And so we too often get resentenced coming out of incarceration, not so much as by the justice system, but by society. And so when I started this program, S&D Enterprises, which refers to as Salvation and Deliverance, the obstacles were there. I mean, I jumped through many hurdles, had many doors shut in my face. People just were not willing to give somebody returning out of prison a second chance. And so in having to reacclimate myself and back into society, there was no Operation New Hope there for me. When I came home, there was nobody out there giving out any advice or know-how as to what do you do. And so reacclimating myself, employment was a huge obstacle. I took a job for $10 an hour when I first came home, and leaving the Central Florida area going to prison, I made six figures. But to come home and have to just really humble yourself and take ownership of why you're in that position, I took that job for $10 an hour, and it was the best decision I could have made. So employment is really, really big. Not to mention the other things, the being redeemed and restored, you know, getting over your trauma, what sent you to prison, the finger pointing, like I said, the shame and the lack of value you may have felt as a returning citizen. Society often reminds you of it. And so I come out of prison with a made up mind. I came out of prison with a plan. And basically, I'm living that purpose today.
So talk to them about the transitional homes that you selling like hotcakes out here.
Well, I'm not selling, but I'm definitely obtaining them. I currently, you know, I come out of prison and I was afforded the opportunity to open my first home 3 years ago. I currently now have 14 homes and three in reserve. I started opening up house number 15 today, but as I was saying earlier, I stopped to be able to be prepared for today, but I am now FAR certified, and our sister company, we're opening three more facilities like going on right now to be able to house the people that are coming out of rehabs with their substance abuse issues, coming out of prison with substance abuse issues, their trauma. But 14 houses later, I've serviced over 200 residents, returning citizens coming out of incarceration. I think we're doing pretty darn good.
And it's cool, gotta come off mute here, but
there it is. There you go.
There he is. It's Fullwood.
Yes, sir.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. Thanks for having me. Sorry, I had to switch my devices. So
no problem. We're real nimble around here. That's how you got to be. That's why I had to tell my trial attorneys, you got to be nimble how you go through your cases. So that's one of the skills you have to implement, because things are not always going to go the way you want. They're going to.
Amen. You know, that sounds like life.
Yeah, they're going to have a witness on the stand. You know, the witness is going to tell you that this story over and over again. You're going to go through this whole testimony with them. And you put them on the stand, and they start doing some crazy things. And you, so you got to be nimble. You got to be ready to adjust.
There you go.
Yeah. So talk to people about Operation New Hope. You know, kind of how you all came about this mission. I think you guys originally started in Jacksonville, correct?
Correct.
Came on down and we're kind of moving, swooping through the state here, and down here in Central Florida. So, talk to the people about, you know, kind of how did you come up to be at this point, and kind of what led you down this road.
All right. Thank you. Well, first, thank you for having us on the program. It's always an honor to talk about the topics of, you know, helping people rebuild their lives and get back on their feet. At Operation New Hope, we've been around for about 25 years. We're headquartered in Jacksonville. We've been in the Orlando area for 3 years now. Mm-hmm. We just celebrated our third year in Orlando, and we've sort of been charged with building a statewide network for this work. And so Orlando was our first major expansion. Now we're in Tampa, St. Pete, Space Coast area, and a small office in St. Augustine as well. So we essentially are a reentry provider. We don't house people directly. We work with people like Sharon to house folks, vendors like her who have programs. But our core of what we do is really the wraparound services that people need when they get out of jail or prison. In Florida, there's about 600,000 people that leave a Florida prison or a local jail every year. And a lot of those people need help. Sorry. Coming on the street. Speaking of needing help.
Somebody getting help.
So a lot of those people need help, just rebuilding their lives and getting back on their feet. So we do job training on site. We provide mental health services. We'll pay for up to 3 months of housing. We pay for, public transportation, vocational training. We'll work with the local state colleges and other providers to make sure that people get vocational training so that they can get a leg up on a lot of the jobs that are available. And again, our goal is to really help people. So we've evolved over our 25 years. To be honest, we didn't start off as a reentry program. We just started hiring people and helping people who had records. And we realized the need to really focus in this space. And so that was about 20 years ago. We really focused attention into reentry. And through trial and error, we've sort of built a really good model. You know, we don't say we're the best in the world, but we know that when you invest in people, the outcomes are better. Recidivism goes down. We know that people get stable. They can get good employment and they can become successful. And so, our goal is to really, if we can help every person leaving a state or a local jail rebuild, refocus, reunify with their families, that's what we want to do. So we'll be continuing to expand throughout the state. We're looking at some South Florida locations, and then we'll go into West Florida as well. And so that's kind of who we are. And we love this work, and we don't hire people who don't care about this work. So we're very passionate about second chances, rebuilding.
All right. So tell me how you guys got a state. You guys got into a state budget line. So I was like, you guys got a statue around you. Like, I mean, I was like, these guys, doing big things in Tallahassee. So talk to people about what kind of how that happened and what's the importance of that happening for this type of work.
Yeah, thanks, Attorney Banks, State Attorney Banks. We realized years ago that in order to consistently do the work that we do, it may require funding. You can have the best heart in the world, the best program, but if you don't have funding, then you won't be successful. And so for years, we applied for federal grants. And our first big grant really was a federal grant. But it had limitations, and those limitations were it was for folks with misdemeanors and really minor felonies. And so there are a ton of people we realized we couldn't help. So we went to our state legislature and asked if they would consider funding our programs. And, we had some really good folks that supported us in Jacksonville who believed in us. And that's how we got our first state line item. And that was about probably 12 or 13 years ago. And mm-hmm. since then, we have, you know, consistently received state funding. And then last year, we were blessed to have a bill that basically put us in state statute as the reentry provider for the state. So that's been very helpful. And, you know, we've worked with the governor's office and the legislature to get that done.
Okay. So, you know, one of the things that I know that they kind of go around a lot. I've seen them a couple in different communities here, especially in Orlando, these reentry simulators. How do you guys feel about them? Do you think they're helpful? Are they realistic? Is there a way that we can help our community buy in, especially our business community, buy in better into those types of those situations?
Well, I would like to address that particular question. I often go to the conferences and they do the simulations at conference and during our workshops. And so somebody that's never experienced being arrested, riding in a police car, going to jail, having to bond out, go to first appearance, going to court, not having a bond, all those issues that you face being arrested and going to jail or even being sentenced to prison. The simulation, you know, takes you through the process and, you know, you laugh about it, you joke about it, but until you've actually been in somebody's shoes that actually go to prison or go to jail, the simulation is just just an eye opener for the people that's sitting behind the desk, like your probation officers, police officers, judges, lawyers, and things of that nature. So I'm here to tell you that nobody has walked in my shoes after going to prison or even being in jail. So simulations, I'm a living proof of what that experience is like. But for somebody that's never really experienced it and you just go through the motions and, you know, you fabricate, you know, what's to be expected, no.
Mm-hmm. So I guess,
I was going to say, I mean, I totally understand what Sharon is saying. I think there is value in the simulators, though, because of, you know, exactly what she said, that a lot of people have never experienced it or they can't even fathom the fact that housing becomes extremely hard. It's not like you can get out and just go apply for an apartment, you know, or, you know, sometimes you burn your bridges with family and et cetera. So I think the simulator is really strong because it does open people's eyes. And it's never going to be accurate, right? Because everybody's lived experience is different. But I do think it's helpful. The problem with the simulator isn't if it's like meaningful or not. To me, the problem is the right people typically aren't in the room.
There you go.
You know, you don't get the elected officials who need to see it. You don't get some of the judges who need to experience it, or even some of the folks from the state attorney's office who need to experience, or employers. Or so oftentimes the question becomes like, how do we get the right people in the room to understand and experience it versus, you know, the same old folks? Like, I mean, a lot of the conferences and a lot of the trainings, it's kind of the folks who you're preaching to the choir. These are people who understand already. So how do we get more people into understanding that these simulators can be effective in at least introducing folks to the struggle?
If the right people are receiving that.
That's what I mean. So I always thought it was like that. I ask the question because I'm like, how do we get businesses, for instance? How do you get people that, you know, some of these like kind of collaborates that own multiple like rental properties and, you know, apartment complexes, like what was it, Cameron or like all these kind of different people, Camden or whatever, all these people that own all these different different properties that rent. The people, also people that, you know, is here locally, you know, how do we get Disney? How do we get Universal or, the hotel and lodging associations and those kind of things like that. How do we get them on board to, you know, kind of have this conversation?
Well, Mr. Bain, you remember, you heard it for yourself firsthand from returning citizens that I house in my program right now from the gala. It's tough. Yes. It's tough out there. They're expecting these, you know, men and women to make 3 times the month rent, credit score over 650, on your job for a certain amount of time. When I came home from prison, making that $10 an hour, I worked long and hard to prove myself back to society. Mm-hmm. And it took a very long, 26 months, 26 months before I was afforded my first opportunity to get my own place. They made me pay 3 times the deposit, plus the first month, plus the application. And then I had to talk my way into it. Everybody doesn't have that talent or that gift, or everybody's not where they're making that kind of money. It was a struggle, several doors. I mean, and then when you're going around, prison doesn't prepare you for what you're coming out to face.
Yeah.
And so I think it needs to start inside the prison also, and the jails. When you become a convicted felon, these are the things that you're facing coming out. It's just crazy. The easiest thing for me to get when I got out was a car. That was the easiest thing for me to get. But that first condo, like I said, 4 times of what it cost a month, plus the application fee, it was ridiculous. And I had worked 26 months on rebuilding my credit. So all that was good until they ran that background. Yeah. And that stops everything. So I said that to say this, even with the second chance employers out there, are you really giving us a second chance? I mean, you talked about this before. You know, so many people, they got this long list that they give you coming out of prison with all these second chance companies on it. But when you get out here and you go to those places, it's a 2-3 month process to be told no.
You saying to get into the program or just the working, the program itself takes 2-3 months?
No, you go to some of these second chance companies out here that saying they give second chances for a job.
Mm-hmm.
And once you fill out that application, and then, you know, if you get a call, let me say, if you get a call, they're running your background, want to know your DNA, you know, just everything about you. So what's the purpose of that? I'm telling you coming in that I'm a convicted felon. These are what my charges are.
So I guess, how do you strike a balance? I mean, because, of course, my wife's a small business owner. You know, she's in the medical field. There are several other people that are, you know, they have these companies, and you know, they're worried about liability, they're worried about their insurance. Mm-hmm. Where should we be pushing on to have those conversations about, protecting the employer while also giving opportunities, these actual second chances to these citizens coming back?
Well, one of the partnerships we have with CareerSource, you're able to be bonded coming out of prison, mm-hmm. or coming out of the county jail. We offer bonding so that tax credit, you know, that helps. If they're really interested in you, but the partnership with your program that I support every time, I mean, the tools are out there. Mm-hmm.
I mean, the bonding is certainly important. I think we got to figure out how to change hearts and minds too.
That, amen.
Because we have employers that the CEO said, you know what, this is important. And so we're going to figure it out. We're not going to listen to the risk management folks or the attorneys or the insurance. We're going to figure it out because this is an important segment of our society. The good news for returning citizens or people with felony backgrounds is there's so many industries that are in desperate need of workers because, you know, we have retiring baby boomers, et cetera. And so a lot of industries that would have never looked at or considered returning citizens in the past are now having to do it. One of the best employers in the country right now for returning citizens is a financial institution, JP Morgan Chase. In the past, they would have never even considered it. Now they have a second chance hiring initiative where they've hired hundreds of people and given them chances, because they've also looked at the numbers and said, wow, when we hire these, our rate of success with returning citizens or folks with backgrounds is better than folks who don't, because most of those folks are so appreciative of the opportunity that they outperform.
That's right.
And so that's typically the type of drive you get from someone, you know, who's made mistakes, like who hasn't made a mistake, right? The difference is some of us got caught and some of us didn't.
And so
companies like the JP Morgan Chases of the world and some of the other big boys who said, look, this is important. That's what we need. We need hearts and minds to change. And then we need the JP Morgan Chases. I know the National Chamber, the Florida Chamber are talking more about this and trying to make it a lot more palatable for some of these companies to take chances.
Yeah. And so how do we, you know, because I ran into a big hurdle early on in what I was like when I was in my position here. And a lot of it had to do with federal regulations and all types of things like that. For instance, like so at GOA, who is, you know, one of the larger employers in our area, here in Central Florida at the Airport Authority, you know, there's this federal regulation that says that you can't be a returning citizen. To do bags, to clean, to do like, you know, like non-secured positions where like you don't, like you're not having national security threats. And, you know, we poked around. I poked around with the FAA, with some other people up there in DC, and, you know, kind of didn't get anywhere. So, you know, is it just, you know, the because we can deal with the corporate people, but, you know, we also got to deal with, you know, the government as well. So, you know, how do we, you know, bring this conversation to a place where we can really make that, you know, that action of returning people actually to work and returning them actually to life? And so kind of, you know, how do you see that future, and, you know, how do we get to that next step?
Like by what we're doing right now, we're talking about it. We must definitely get to our legislator and bring these issues up and talk about them. But like Mr. Full was said, corporations that have a changed heart or see the vision, because this is definitely a vision that somebody has to have other than ourselves. I only employ convicted felons or returning citizens. To afford another second chance for somebody.
Yeah, and Judge, you bring up a good point, because one of the challenges in some of the federal rules of change, if you think about even housing, for years, decades, if you had a felony, you could not rent in public housing. How asinine is that?
And it's still the same way.
Yeah, and I think they've tried to change some of the laws, some of the criteria has changed, but how foolish is that some of our lowest income people can't rent public housing because they have a background? It's ludicrous. And so some of those laws, you're right. So some of it's federal. Some of the federal laws have to change. We had a port academy at one point. We were trying to help train people for port jobs because there was a great need. Then we found out that with the TWIC badges, there's an appeal process, but hell, it takes about 2 years to go through because you need a TWIC badge to work on a federal port. So the federal government regulates ports, port authorities. And so the appeals process was taking 2 years. Like you could eventually maybe go through the appeal process. And so by then people have moved on or they've given up. And so you're right. There's a lot of regulatory changes that need to be made, a lot of policy changes. And it's mostly on the federal level, some on the state level, and some local governments. But it's almost like we have to run parallel efforts. It has to be the private sector and public sector have to really focus on second chances. Because again, if you run the numbers, we work with staffing agencies all the time, and companies tell us like, wow, your numbers are better than the staffing agencies we use. Well, because again, our people are going to be more appreciative, more focused. Now, nobody bats 1,000. Clearly, there's going to be people who aren't ready for change.
That's right.
But I guarantee you, most of the folks who you give a chance will be appreciative and bust their butts for the company.
Yeah. Yeah. So do you think that, private should drive the public interest? You know, because I'm thinking about like your port example. I believe the airport as well. Thinking about, commerce, those all paid for run through by either fully private or some kind of semi-private industry, Postal Service or UPS or FedEx or, DHL or, any of these other logistic type organizations, no different, and fuel as well, it's like things. And so the port, those all privately funded, kind of things that private companies that have those funding, should they be the ones having the conversation on Capitol Hill about this issue? Or should we, because we're having this grassroots conversation like we are, but right. How do we get that to the, to the people that can actually push money and push weight to, make the understanding happen?
Yeah, I think it does have to happen through coalition building. And I think it has to be returning citizens sort of uniting and having a voice and going to elected officials and having their employers also talk about the benefits. And so it has, and so the coalition has to be individuals and individuals who are affected by the justice system, as well as employers who really care, who are socially conscious. And then, then governmental officials who know that these programs work and support these programs. The Trump administration did a really good job on criminal justice reform initiatives. And it'll be interesting to see how diligent or focused they are on them this time. Right. But the first time around, they did a really good job on focusing on criminal justice reform. So I think, if we can get these administrations focused and we get the business community and we get returning citizens and we build a coalition and push. And unfortunately, sometimes coalitions are tough to build because of, the gap between, the employers and the returning citizens and elected officials. But I mean, that's the way to do it. I mean, we really need sort of a really broad coalition of folks that know the benefits of changing our policies and practices to make it happen.
Yeah.
So I guess I got to be the devil's advocate a little bit. So do you think, let's say we get everything we want. Let's say we get unrestricted access to housing, unrestricted access to not all employment, because there's just going to be some jobs that national security jobs and different types of things that are not going to probably ever going to, I don't think the government's going to go that far. So we're going to be more realistic about what we're going to ask for. But let's say we have access to at least like the good jobs. Do you think that the status will stay the same? Because what we're really basing a lot of on is that people are appreciative because it's so hard right now. So do we make it easier? Does it change performance? Do we have fear of that? How does that work?
I think it will change. I think it will drastically change. Mm-hmm. State Attorney Bain, it's just so hard out there. I advocate every day. I beat these streets every day, going into companies. And I'm a boisterous person. I have no fear in me to walk into companies and explain who I am, where I've come from, what I'm doing in the community that I live in, and why I'm in your establishment today. Everybody's not able to do that. But guess what? Once they hear what I got to say, they're interested. So I think we do need to go at, in a collaborative group. They need to hear it more. But people will be happy to get a job today than being told, I'll call you. I got your application or I got your resume. I got 10 other people I got to interview. I'm not coming to you because I don't see your now hiring sign on the window. I'm coming to you because I do see it and I need a job. So, like I said, I advocate every day for residents that are coming home. And I thank companies that hire my residents that live in my program. I thank them because that's an opportunity for somebody to get it right, to be successful, to not recidivize or go back to jail or revert back to their old ways to make a living. And so if you coming out of prison or you coming out of jail with a made up mind, a plan, that's what I wrote my 501c3 on. the legacy project of change choices. I had to change my choices. I had to make better choices for myself, better decisions. And in doing so, I stayed the course. You think I wanted to take a job for $10 an hour? No, but guess what? I humbled myself down because I had a plan. I had made up my mind that I'm tired of going back and forth to jail. Prison was not the place for me, and I don't want to return. So there are a lot of people that sit in my office or come in my doors and say, thank you, Ms. Driver, for giving me a second chance. What do I do next?
Yeah, I think the more we make it easier for people affected by the justice system to get jobs and build careers, living wage jobs and good careers, I think the more successful we'll be. I mean, I think right now people are caught in this cycle of poverty because they don't have a way out. So if you open up the opportunities, I think instead of people taking it for granted, I think we'll see tremendous advances in the number of folks who are successful. Because Sharon is right. A lot of people have the drive. Like, she has the drive, I have the drive. There's a lot of people who have the drive and determination to be successful and mm-hmm. have that passion, right? A lot of people get beat down by, like, one or two obstacles can break some people. 10 obstacles won't break me. 20 obstacles won't break me because I'm going to keep going. But that doesn't mean everybody's built the same way. So I think that if we can absolutely create easier paths, I think we'll see more success.
Mm-hmm. And so I heard Mr. Bain also at the gala, what were they telling you? Discipline. Yeah. Discipline is a huge part of my organization. And I mean, everybody don't like discipline. Everybody don't like structure. You know, I often get critiqued because, you know, I'm either too hard or not willing to bend. Well, guess what? Look where I got by not bending or staying on the course of being disciplined. Discipline myself, yeah. You know, to stay focused. And like he said, people come out and they really want to, but not everybody. How many doors I told you closed in my face?
Yeah.
How many opportunities I've asked for people to give me a second or third chance? Mr. Fullwood can attest to that. I've asked for second and third chances, even from himself. But I'm just saying, people don't, you know, we get so resentenced. Society often resentences us. And I said that at the gala. I'm about second chances, third, fourth, fifth, whatever it takes to help somebody's success. But it's a mental thing too for people that keep trying.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, always, you know, one of my biggest things I always talk about, and we also, somebody was talking about your gala, you know, both of them had to deal with, you know, the trauma. And not the trauma, just the trauma of like being in prison, but the trauma of like what kind of led you to where you are.
That's right.
You know, so I've done almost every episode I speak about, you know, PACES and those type of different things that lead our children to being adults that have these issues. So how do we make this better? I mean, like, how do, is this not the, on the reentry side, how do we address it? I'm on the intervention side on the other part of it, but you know, to deal with the cycles of poverty, because poverty, that is an average childhood experience. You growing up in poverty is an average childhood experience. Like, that's, you are, so you're already like, just because where you grew up is already that way. Then you add in all the other environmental things, you know, quickly, if you grew up in a low income neighborhood, you know, you have about three or four environmental and or in your house, average childhood experiences going on. So how do we start addressing those situations, you know, systematically, especially when people are leaving incarceration and getting back into our society?
Well, one of the things that I do know that Operation New Hope offers, because I still have residents that I have from Operation New Hope, being able to have somebody to talk to, that mental health piece is crucial to returning back into society. If you don't address that mental piece, that trauma that affected you, that got you to where you went, you're not gonna succeed. You're not gonna be successful. And that's where it essentially starts. You have to talk about what got you to where you're coming from. And if you don't tackle these issues, remember I said, I think I was in my 40s before I ever addressed my childhood trauma. But I addressed it, and I'm past that. I don't allow my past to really dictate my future. I take each day, every day, you know, one step forward. But we must start listening. I have mentees that I mentor to, and the main thing I do, I let them talk. We got to listen to the youth today. We got to listen to what's your problem? And if we're thinking that we can solve their problem by talking over them, we're never going to get anywhere. When they leave out that door, they're going to say, oh, that wasn't no help. But we got to start with the mental issue. That's crucial. And there's no way around it.
I agree. I think, you know, we start with mental health is such a big part of the work we do. And, you know, we talked about trauma-informed care earlier. I tell people all the time, whether you spend one day in jail, 1 hour, or 10 years or 20 years, you're dealing with some post-traumatic stress from it.
Right.
And anytime you're incarcerated, anytime you're handcuffed, there's some trauma related to that. And so one of the things we try to do is build trust first. And because Sharon is right, the ability to talk through issues and really be honest and self-aware is so critical. And the success our clients who've been the most successful have been probably the most self-aware of, hey, this is what happened and this is what led me down this path and this is why I need to focus on not doing this or not going in this place. And so I think that mental health part is probably the most critical. And we try to start the work that we do behind the bars so that before people get out, so that we can really set them up for success. But, you know, it's just really, it's really tough, especially in African-American community, because I think we made a lot of advances in where we believe that therapy is okay, but there's still a stigma related to people who attest like, yeah, I'm in therapy or I need therapy. I think it's still a challenge in the African-American community and maybe the Latino community as well. But we got to get past that stigma and that stereotype that there's something wrong with wanting or needing mental health services.
I want to add something. One thing I learned sitting in prison, I often say this, and it might sound crazy to people, but if you really can relate to where I'm coming from, the best 5 years of my life was spent in incarceration. It allowed me time to really address who I was and find my own self. You know, it allowed me time to sit and think and get into my word or, you know, my own Christianity and things of that nature. But I look at what I'm doing today. I'm serving a purpose out of the pain that I went through in my childhood trauma, doing time. I'm now serving a purpose because I've had time to relate and time to think and talk to someone. Not on a bunch of medications or, you know, taking self-awareness tests, but just merely talking, getting things off my chest. I spend a lot of time in my office just listening to the residents. And then they tend to open up and get things off their chest. Talk about things they never would share with a mother, a father, a sister, a brother, a lawyer, anyone. But being able to relate with them, I get a lot of people want to make appointments to sit in my office to talk about what they're going through.
So I guess this is my next question. It's like, so, you know, years ago, Florida gave up on parole. Like, you know, back in the 90s, I think they gave up on parole. But I think the idea of parole was kind of like, the idea was that, was like the reentry for people. But then it turned into like this punitive bureaucracy. And so that's always my fear of, like, you know, that this is, because really, to be systematic about it, it would have to come from the system. But the problem is, will the system turn it into something that doesn't help people get to where they're supposed to be? And so, you know, how do we balance those two things? Because to get where we really want to be, there's going to be a system in place, and it's going to mean there's a law is going to be passed. It's going to be mandatory for people to involve themselves, and then somebody's going to supervise it and pay for it. It's going to be this whole thing. Kind of how do we avoid the mistakes of the past and kind of forge a future forward in making sure that we're providing those tools with mental health, providing the the access to housing, skills. I spoke at your gallery, talked about people having soft skills. So I can teach you how to be a mechanic, I can teach you how to be an electrician, carpenter, IT, a bunch of other things, but if you don't have the soft skills, you're not going to keep a job. So how do we become systematic without losing what we're trying to achieve at the same time?
Education is important. Education is very important.
And I also think, Judge, that you talked about how we ended the parole system. I think we should have looked at amending versus ending, because rewarding good behavior is actually a great thing when it comes to incarceration. And if you look at the state that probably has had the most impact in criminal justice reform and prison reform, it's Texas. They reduced their prison population by like 30 or 40% over the last 10 years because they got smarter about incarceration and looking at, instead of putting like certain white collar crimes, like why would I send them to prison when I can put them on house arrest and make sure they're working and contributing back to society and fine them, et cetera. Or I look at certain long-term offenses and do something different. So I think there are ways to be smarter about this that aren't liberal ways.
Yeah, false question. Oh, we lost them. All right, we'll get back. Maybe Sharon can cut in, well, maybe we can fix Ray's mic.
Okay. Definitely. I'm huge on education. A lot of our men and women that are coming out of prison, State Attorney Bain, they can't even read and write.
Yep.
They can't even read and write. So, when you're in there, while you're there, certain things need to be mandatory for you to even exit prison during your sentence. If you're coming in and you don't have a high school diploma, you can't read and write, you don't know how to sign your name, you're coming out, you already got a strike against you.
Where you got your back? Oh, you're muted. Oh,
yes, I'm here.
Whatever, you can hear your sound cut off. Like in the middle, you're talking about Texas.
Oh, wow. I had to call coming out and realize it would turn off. I was just sort of making the point that if a red state like Texas can focus on prison reform and have the significant impacts they've had in reducing prison population, being smarter about incarceration efforts, and not only are they saving billions of dollars a year in the state budget, but they're also giving people opportunities to just, they're giving real second chance opportunities by saying, look, every one of these crimes shouldn't require imprisonment. Let's look at some alternative ways of dealing with them that continue to make, allow these folks to be taxpaying citizens that are connected with their families. Because again, the reunification of families is so important. And when you're taking people away from their families, particularly for some of the crimes that we're incarcerating people for, that's the sort of smart justice we have to focus on. And to me, having gain time for good behavior, for like Sharon just talked about, for getting my GED, for getting my electrical certification or my phlebotomist certification or whatever the heck it is, like, we should reward that behavior, because what happens is, my sentence got reduced by 2 years, but now I have all this education. When I get out, I'm more
get employable.
It's easier for me to get a job, because guess what? I got my forklift certification. I got my heavy machinery certification. Now I can go to Granger or Ring Power or one of these heavy machinery guys and say, hey, I have this. I'm a step ahead of folks.
He got it.
Likely to commit a crime or recidivate, because now I have all these opportunities because I got so much training, and I was rewarded for that training by a reduction in time served.
Yeah. It also reduces the shame and lack of value when they're coming out of incarceration also. Like I said, you know, if you don't have that strong will or that strong mind, or you don't keep turning the knob and keep walking through the doors, when you are getting that education, you're coming out of prison with your GED, you're not ashamed to say, well, I got it while I did my time. It reduces that shame and lack of value that men and women face. You don't know how many applications myself or my staff have filled out for somebody coming home that could not read the application.
Yeah, I get it. I mean, that's, you know, literacy is one of my big things. So, the statistics are very clear. 3 out of 5 of people in prison are illiterate. And about 85% of the kids I have in my juvenile justice system are functionally illiterate. Actually, my next wave of kids are graduating in 2 weeks from our Turning Pages program, literacy program. So that's an easy win for our. I don't understand why we can't fund this in a way that makes sense, but I will one day, maybe with Reggie's help, I'll get there, because I'm like, this is an easy win, people. Like, this is not a hard thing to understand. Like, these kids, it's ABC. It's that simple. It's like ABC 1, 2, 3, because the kids that I have, that, you know, even the kid that committed that horrific shooting downtown on the 1st, same thing, he has a 0.096 GPA in high school.
Wow.
You know what I'm saying? So, I mean, it's not, I mean, we can't just sit there and continue. I give up that soapbox for a while. Educating the kids the way we're educating them. We can clearly identify that these kids that have these certain traits have are likely to cause, be caught up in some serious crimes later on, and we just sit there and basically don't do anything. Right. But we could probably do a whole basic episode about that. But we will get there. But as long as I can try to, use my influence to make that happen, I will continue to do that. It's discipline. So we Sharon brought it up. Reggie, I don't know if you can weigh in a little bit about discipline for the, you got about 60 seconds, and then I got to jump into ending the show here, and how important that is in making sure that we are going to be successful.
I want to tap into one more quick thing that we must also deal with and address in incarceration is the substance abuse.
Yeah,
I know that's for another day, but yeah, That's got to be addressed. So many people are struggling with the substance mm-hmm. abuse issue, and that's an individual thing. That's not a company thing. That's an individual thing, but we must help them in that substance abuse area, which is why, my brother's company, we're now FAR certified, because we are a true recovery center for helping those that are returning citizens that need that extra.
Go, Reggie, on discipline.
Oh yeah. So I mean, I think it's important. Discipline and structure are critical. It's somebody with kids. I think one of the disservices parents do is when they're trying to be buddies to their kids versus trying to provide parental discipline and guidance. And so I think it's the same thing with adults. I mean, you have to hold people accountable. And so I think in order for people to really reacclimate back to society and rebuild their lives, there has to be a level of discipline related to that. And so the structure they receive, whether it's in prison or in the halfway house afterwards or when they get out, I mean, there has to be a level of discipline. So I think folks like me who kind of promote being smarter on crime, we get a tag of, you're soft on crime. No, I believe in discipline and there is. There's repercussions to your actions. There's penalties for your actions. So I certainly believe in that. So discipline is critical to our society in general. That's not the issue at all. It's the thought that we the system should make people better versus making people worse.
Exactly. So that's really what I want to end with, that because my motivational minute was about discipline and how the wise accept discipline and the fools, you know, turn away from discipline. So with that, we are at our hour moment, and always a great conversation to have. We'll continue to have this conversation. We'll talk about substance abuse in a different one, but I look forward to having you on again. And well, I'll see everyone else next week for another conversation with State Attorney Bain.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Community Conversations with State Attorney Bain. Join us again next Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. for another episode. Looking for